Hi, my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. On today's show, I am going to be talking about a book called A Modern Guide to Sherry, The Wine World's Best Kept Secret with Cocktails and Recipes by Talia Bioki. First of all, I should preface this book by saying it's not a new book. I know most of the books I've talked about this season have been like really current releases from 2020 or 2021. This was actually published in 2014, but it's been on my mind recently, Sherry has. And well, how do I describe it? So I'm going to quote from the introduction to this book. Sherry is a wine that has endured through thousands of years of political upheaval, sacking, conquest, and economic disappointment. But Sherry's highs have certainly outweighed its lows. It was practically the official drink of 15th and 16th century explorers, a favorite of everyone from Shakespeare to Poe to Dickens, the base of the sherry cobbler, one of the greatest American cocktails ever invented, and believe it or not, one of the muses of California's nascent wine-producing industry. So it's not hyperbole when I say, this is the author speaking, that Sherry's story is one of the most remarkable in the history of wine. She's not wrong. I would also like to expand upon that and say not only has it been a favorite and mentioned from folks like Edgar Allan Poe, but also in the words of Steve Perry in the 1984 seminal hit, former frontman of Journey, "Oh Sherry, our love holds on, holds on." All right, folks, let's get tore up from the floor up. We're going to talk about some sherry. This episode is sponsored by Study Hall, my show on Psalm TV, where you can learn the ins and outs of being a sommelier and get helpful hints and tips for studying for your exams. Not a subscriber? Well, you can get a year of Psalm TV for 50% off with the code STUDYHALL. That's all one word, STUDYHALL, and you'll get a year's subscription for only $25. All right, so this book is, well, it's a beautiful little book. It's about, I don't know, like 5x7, and it's a hardback book, and the cover reminds me of kind of a bottle of sherry, like a La Cigarrera or Hidalgo La Gitana. It's kind of like off-white with red and gold. And I think that's not actually a coincidence that it's meant to look like a bottle of sherry. Just a little bit about the author, Talia Bioki. I hope I'm saying her last name right. I've never actually met her, but I am familiar with her work. And she is currently the founder and editor-in-chief of Punch, which is a James Beard award-winning online magazine devoted to drinks and drinking culture. And as I mentioned, and that website, by the way, it's an online publication or it's an online kind of outlet. It has articles and columns and recipes and things like that. She knows her stuff. And this book, I should say, is, well, it covers a lot of ground. So it's divided into an introduction, how sherry is made, the process of making the wines of the sherry spectrum, sherry throughout the ages, the modern sherry renaissance, the towns and the bodegas, sherry cocktails, and then sherry at the table. So sherry has a long history, centuries worth of history. One thing I really like about the beginning of this book is it draws a very strong parallel to another wine of terroir and process, one of my favorite beverages, champagne. And there are a lot of similarities between these two wines. They come from very unique areas, very diametrically opposite areas, and they make a wide variety of different types of wines. But I think the consuming population dumps them all into like one kind of category. They're a little misunderstood. Now you might say, whoa, Jill, who misunderstands champagne? Well, I think a lot of people do. I think a lot of people, and I've said this before, think of it as an expensive French, some people don't even realize it's French, sparkling wine, which all those things are true, check, check, check. And a lot, well, probably way more people misunderstand sherry. The most common misunderstanding about sherry is the assumption that it's sweet. And while sherry does produce sweet wines, it also produces some of the driest wines in the world. It has a wide variety of styles. It can be made from multiple different grape varieties. Same thing is true with champagne. There's different styles of aging. And of course, where it comes from and the producers are all kind of important stories. So there's a really strong connection between the two. So I think I cannot probably do a single podcast without referring to my bestie, my homegirl, Jancis Robinson. But in the World Atlas of Wine, she sums it up, the bond between sherry and champagne the best, and says, they are the far northern, that would be champagne, and far southern, that would be sherry, interpretations of the same equation or the same poem, the white grape from the white ground. So the major grape variety or the grape varieties used in sherry are all white grape varieties. The major one is called Palomino Fino. There's also one called Pedro Ximenez and then Moscatel. They make for different types of sherry. Interestingly, not all sherry is white or kind of that yellowish color. Some of them are nearly opaque and black like motor oil. And we'll get into that later, but there are different soil types in sherry as there are in champagne. But the most prized is this very white soil called Albariza. Forgive me, I worked for a Spaniard for a long time. I can't not put in my Spanish lisp, Albariza. But it's this really unique white chalky soil that is very water retentive. And that's really important. It's not the same type of soil as in the Champagne region, but they do have some of the same properties. And so you have these famed grapes growing in this famed white soil. And so they are, well, they're like sisters from another mister. So Sherry, let's understand Sherry. And this podcast is not to explain this category of wine, but it's so misunderstood. We got to dissect it just a little bit. So Sherry is a fortified wine, which means by definition, it has alcohol added to it. And there's several purposes for that. Obviously, adding alcohol, in this case, like a neutral grape brandy, increases the alcoholic content. And that plays an important role in certain types of sherry. It makes it more stable in some cases for long sea voyages, as it were. And there are certainly unfortified sherries, but by definition, it's generally believed to be a fortified wine and it's attached to a place. So sherry comes from southern Spain, from Andalusia, and it's like the most southern you can get in Spain. You could like look across the sea and see Morocco. And I talked about this, I've been there once and I've only been to one of the major towns. So sherry encompasses 9 different municipalities, but one of the kind of famed things about sherry, it's called the Sherry Triangle, and it's these 3 towns, and they are called El Puerto de Santa Maria, Sanlúcar de Barrameda, and Jerez de la Frontera. And these 3 towns form a triangle, and grapes for sherry production can be grown throughout 9 provinces, not just in these 3 towns. And the wine can be pressed, but the long-standing rule in sherry is, and it requires very specific and long aging, and there's a unique process in that. But the aging for sherry up until like this year, last month, has stipulated that sherry has to be aged in the Sherry Triangle in these 3 towns. There's a unique aging process to sherry that is very similar to champagne. While there are añada or vintage sherries that are made from the harvest of just one particular year, they're very atypical and rare. And the majority of sherry that's produced is a blend of wine from different harvests, sort of like the idea of a non-vintage dated champagne. However, they do it a little differently in sherry. So in addition to, you know, these white grapes from the specific ground with, you know, certain aging qualifications and requirements, the typical process for making sherry is you harvest these grapes, you crush them, and you ferment the grapes into a still wine. It makes for fairly, well, not like boring, but not super characterful wine. And this wine, depending on the style of sherry that you're going to be making, will be fortified to different levels of alcoholic strength. A lower level, like 15 to 15.5 degrees alcohol, if it's meant to be a certain type of sherry, and then a higher degree of alcohol, like 17, if it's meant to be another type. And the reason for that is there's a magical thing that exists in sherry and very few other places around the world. And I should say, when I say sherry, the official appellation or denominación de origen is Jerez sherry, and Jerez is spelled 2 different ways. So it's spelled with an X, with a J, or just the anglicized sherry. So you can use any of those terms interchangeably. They're all correct. But the process by which, you know, these wines are made, a big influence is this natural phenomenon, which is the development of something that sounds gross, but is actually delicious. So after they make these wines, these still-based wines, they're categorized based on style. They're fortified to different levels of alcoholic strength based on style and potential for aging. And then they're put into barrels. Now, they don't use brand new barrels in sherry. They don't generally use new barrels in champagne, but they don't fill them all the way full, which might sound a little bit, you know, scary or worrisome. But the idea is that by not filling them 100% full, because of where sherry is uniquely located, the southern tip of Spain, that this veil of yeast can develop. So it's called the velo or the voile in French, and it's called flor in Spanish. And well, it's described in this book as looking like a 1970s popcorn ceiling, which depending on the age of you, dear listener, you may or may not know what that looks like. But if you've ever lived in like a really like basic apartment, you might've seen a popcorn ceiling. It's kind of like fluffy and white. It's not smooth. But this veil of yeast develops and it's seasonal. It's like thick and fluffy in, you know, some seasons, and it's kind of sparse and gray in others. But there's only a few places around the world where this naturally will develop. And it serves a very specific purpose. It protects the wine from oxidation because the barrels aren't all the way full. It contributes flavor and aroma. It's really fascinating stuff. And it'll form or not form depending on the strength of the sherry. So in some types where the flor forms, it protects the wines from oxidation. So they're white wines. So if you see a Fino sherry or a Manzanilla sherry, they are kind of pale straw in color. If you fortify the wine to a higher degree of alcohol, it will not form. It's too much alcohol. And the wine will be oxidative, so it'll be brown. So if you see an Amontillado or a Palo Cortado or an Oloroso, they're brown sherries. Regardless of the color, these are all dry sherries. So everybody thinks you know, who is yet unfamiliar, that sherry is sweet. And they do make sweet wines. And there's whole categories addressed in this book. But Talia does a really nice job of dissecting the style of wine making, because there's a lot of technical terms and there's a lot of steps. And anyone who's ever done any sort of wine certification, you're probably going to have to memorize these terms and these steps. This book is a really good source for that. Now, as I go start talking about sherry, and you know, it's this, you know, non-vintage dated largely wine that's fortified, that comes from southern Spain. There's some kind of general characteristics. I should say, this is a reference text, and it's not just a reference text, but it does have like serious scholastic academic information. But the wine world is ever a changing. And it is worth noting, and I've mentioned this, I think, in a couple of podcasts this season or last, when that's like a new development, it's like super exciting in the world of wine, because they've been making wine here for centuries, right? In May of 2021, this year, it was first codified and then finalized in August of 2021. It is October. This is brand spanking new, hot off the presses information. But there have been fundamental changes to the rules and regulations for DO sherry. This is the sixth time in the 86-year history of the DO, because the DOs throughout Europe, or the versions thereof in different countries, were largely established in the beginning of the 20th century. This is the sixth time the rules have fundamentally changed. So I won't go into that now, but if you are studying for some sort of wine certification, or you just want to be like up to date on what's happening in the world of wine, you need to, you know, look up and read some information on the new regulations for DO sherry. Obviously, this book was written in 2014. These things didn't exist then. It does not negate any of the information in this book. There's just updates and some changes. So like 98% of the information in this book is still accurate and useful, but there have been some new things. So just, that's a little bit of a like flashing red light. You need to do a little bit of homework. You need to attend some study halls and do a little bit of reading on what's new, brand spanking new, in the world of sherry. So she talks about how sherry is made, which is really important because there are so many steps. There's these specific terms and specific roles that people play. And then she does dissect the wines of the sherry spectrum, and say that three times fast. And it is really important because there are different names and there are different producers and they all have different flavor profiles. And I have been appreciating and loving sherry from relatively early on in my career as a sommelier. So early on, actually, my very first job as a sommelier was working for a pretty famous chef, a Spanish chef, Jose Andres. And well, he is credited largely for bringing the trend of tapas-style cuisine to the United States from Spain in the early 1990s. And he has built an empire. And I worked for his company, which is now called Think Food Group, for 6 years and was the wine director of that company for several. And the flagship restaurant in that company is a Spanish tapas restaurant called Jaleo. There are Jaleos all over the country now. I am delighted to say that there is now a Jaleo in Chicago, and I can get my fix of sherry and sherry cocktails and Spanish wine. I mean, you can get Spanish wine in a lot of places, but also the delicious cuisine that I ate for years and years and years when I was living in DC. So in a Spanish tapas restaurant, and I should mention that tapas is believed to have originated in Andalusia. So this area in southern Spain, we talk about how if there's a long gastronomic history in an area and they also have a vinous history, if they're making wine, that these two things naturally go together. There's an adage in the wine world that if it grows together, it goes together. And this is true. This is not the only, you know, cultural contribution that Andalusia has given to the world. They've also given us flamenco. And I believe also Jose Andres's wife, Tichy. I believe she's also from Andalusia. So I digress. There is discussion at the end of this book about classic food pairings for sherry. And one of the things that's really fun is, yes, it does go very, very well with classic Spanish cuisine. And the author does talk about sort of the origin of this style of cuisine called tapas, which is small plates. And, you know, there's a couple of different stories, but the one that she likes most, I think makes the most sense, is that tapas originated 600 years after the first reputed origin story in the 19th century, when bars and taverns used to put little saucers over glasses of sherry to keep the flies out and preserve the wine's aroma. It's logical, right? Usually, if there's multiple explanations, what is it, Occam's razor? The simplest explanation is probably the true one. And I'm inclined to believe that. And so on top of the saucer that was placed over, you know, the wine glass, the barkeepers might offer a slice of jamón, which is Spanish cured ham. either alone or maybe on top of bread as like a little welcoming gesture. And so this idea of tapas involved into this idea of a collection of small plates where you would like basically do a bar crawl. And you would go in and like different bars would specialize in different food. And then you would sip a little sherry. And tapas is all over the world now, but it did originate in southern Spain. And look, there is little better than like some jamón ibérico and some like delicious fino sherry. It is one of life's great and simple pleasures, to be sure. But sherry is a great food wine in many ways. And there is kind of a neat or kind of clever way of describing pairing. And as a sommelier, I have utilized sherry in pairings for years. And well, it's not always the most well-received pairing. I don't know how to describe this any other way, but it's new to a lot of people. This is a wine that's been around for hundreds of years, but its flavors, while very easy to appreciate, different types of sherry taste like green apples and almonds and walnuts and maple. And there's all these different flavors, raisins sometimes, all these things that taste good, but you maybe aren't used to having them in a glass of wine. And so they can be really hard for guests to like understand and appreciate. And so there's a little kind of rule of pairing, which she just suggests, because I say rule and I don't really mean rule. So there's, an adage about, and it's included in a little two-page feature in this book called Serving and Storing Sherry. And the adage or advice about pairing sherry is that you should use fino or manzanilla if it swims, if the food item swims, amontillado if it flies, and oloroso if it walks, which is kind of funny if you think about it, because sherry is the southernmost, you know, Jerez is the most southern part of Spain. It's basically surrounded by the Atlantic, and fino and manzanilla sherry are the lightest and most delicate. And of course, they go with lots of things, but like one of the regional specialties of that area is something called tortilla de camarón. So it's like a little shrimp fritter, essentially. So if it swims, fino or manzanilla. If it flies, so an amontillado is sort of the next step in the sherry spectrum, a wine that starts off like a fino sherry, and then it kind of evolves and it turns into something a little bit richer and darker. And so something, imagine like duck or chicken or something like that, a little heartier. And then if it walks, and like the logical explanation would be like beef or pork. Now, you can certainly pair these wines with all different sorts of things. And I have to varying success in different times in my career. One time when I was at Alinea, we had a course that was basically inspired by Spanish tapas. And this, I should mention, course made its way onto the menu right after we had done our traveling pop-up to Spain for a few weeks. And I recounted in a previous episode how one of the other sommeliers, Alinea and I, we took a little weekend trip to Sanlúcar de Barrameda, which is one of the three towns in the Sherry Triangle. We made a visit to one of the sherry bodegas, Bodega Hidalgo La Gitana. And I, of course, I think I recounted my Jerezano hangover. and I did talk about in that same podcast about how Steven Spurrier discovered the cure for the Jerezano hangover, which I did not know about then, which would be, of course, taking a copita of the sweetest of all sherries, Pedro Ximena's, in a shot. I wish I knew then what I know now. But I also know that drinking that much sherry is probably a bad idea. But we had, you know, enjoyed all this sherry. We were so inspired. And then when this course came on the menu that was inspired by tapas, we knew, like, this is what we're going to pair. And we were able to get some really, really great sherries. And I would say that, you know, guests going into a 3 Michelin star tasting menu experience are generally open to trying everything. That said, I don't know. I could pull my friends from the time, but like, maybe 50 to 60, 70% of guests appreciate it. And some are just like, no, I don't like that, which is sad because these were excellent wines. And I'm not going to lie, the pairing is great, but the pairing is only as good as the palate of the beholder. And these are hard wines for some people to appreciate. And so I think it's important for us, those of us who love wine, to keep buying them and drinking them and selling them and talking about them, because sherry needs help. There have been, you know, ebbs and flows in the world with regard to the popularity of this beverage. It has been some of the most popular and widely consumed wine on the planet. And then it has gone from, you know, the highest of the highs to the lowest of the lows. And that's interesting to me because, and one of the reasons I wanted to revisit this book is because part of my wine certification journey has been to complete the diploma with the Wine and Spirits Education Trust. And there's 6 different parts of the diploma, and the WSET's very different from the Court of Master Sommeliers. You oftentimes have to write papers, and they've changed the process because I've been doing this for a while. But there used to be a part of one of the sections where it was called a case study, and they send you a brief, essentially, a concept or an idea, and you have, I don't know how many weeks to research it. And then you show up on test day and you don't know what the actual question they're going to ask you is, but you have an idea because you got a brief. And then you just write an essay and you're expected to like provide evidence, quotes if you've got them. And I was so excited. This is a couple years ago when I got my brief and it was all about sherry and the ebbs and flows of sherry in the world of wine. And so this book was one of the books that I referenced. And I should say that the author says, and I will back her up, that perhaps the greatest book on the planet about sherry is not this one. She doesn't quite say it that way. This is a great book on sherry, and I'll detail it in my rating. But there is a book written by one of the greatest writers who I've, you know, totally talked about in this podcast before, a man named Peter Leem, who also authored a fantastic book on champagne. And Peter Leem, along with a man named Jesus Barquin, wrote a book called Sherry, Manzanilla, and Montilla. And these are different styles of fortified wines from Andalusia. And this book was published in 2012, but it's out of print. And I would love to have reviewed it on this podcast, but if you can find it, you can only find it used, and it's usually like at least $500. So it's not reasonable to, I think, read and recommend a book that is not gettable for probably most people who are listening to this podcast. This book is a really good companion to that, but I actually borrowed a copy of Peter Leem's book from a friend, and I use both of these books as research for this unit in the diploma. And the ebbs and flows of sherry throughout the centuries are covered in this book. She does a really nice job of detailing why and how sherry has gone kind of boom and bust. And it's on its way back. And that's a good thing for all of us because it is really delicious. And there are reasons why it has. But one of the, I think, funniest parts about this book, when sherry has been maybe in more of the bust part of the world, is the author's first, I guess her first sip of sherry. She says it all begins with a stoned surfer, a liquor store on the Pacific Coast Highway, a car full of high school girls, and a botched request for Bailey's. So Bailey's Irish Cream, I'm sure anyone who is familiar with beverage alcohol is familiar with Bailey's Irish Cream. Goes really well in like coffee or hot cocoa, or I guess on your own. And I guess when she was in high school with a bunch of her high school girlfriends, they were trying to buy something to drink, probably underage, clearly, because they were high school girls. And she couldn't remember or mistook Bailey's Irish Cream for something called Harvey's Bristol Cream. And that's a style of sherry. It's a blended sweetened sherry. It's generally considered to be a much lower quality. And it's probably a lot of the reason why people think that sherry is sweet. And so she totally inadvertently tasted sherry for the first time by accident and also tasted a poor example of it. But it is kind of funny that in this really well-organized and informative book, what got her started was definitely not the most illustrious example of the wine. But you know what? All of our journeys in this wine world are circuitous at best. And so you got to start somewhere. Now, her second sip of sherry, she details, I think it was at like Casamono in New York. And it was like really high quality Oloroso, or maybe it was Bar Jamon, but it was like really high quality Oloroso. And well, let's just say it was a very different experience. Gosh, she's a really good writer. And she describes it. She had a chilled copito, which is just the traditional glass for drinking sherry. It's like a small little stemmed glass. And it was Oloroso. She said it was incredibly foreign and totally familiar, like old Barolo laced with iodine that was amplified, reduced, and somehow elegant despite its heft. It sparked that dull, joyous pulse in the gut that travels north, gains momentum in the chest, and releases all its pent-up energy behind the eyes in the same way that good 90s rock choruses, eggs with truffles on them, love, Barolo, and log rides do. It's a variety of bliss. And I was like, oh, hot damn, what beautiful language. Like, that's just so nice. And it's so funny that like her first taste was like liquor store cream sherry, sweet, blended, nondescript, not illustrious. And then her second was like a come to Jesus moment. And that's sometimes all it takes is to find like a wine that rocks your world. She details, you know, sherry's course throughout the 90s. And many people of a certain generation, and I'm including myself in that generation, before they ever got into wine, might have watched the TV show Frasier. And sherry was the preferred drink of Niles and Fraser Crane. It didn't do much for sherry's reputation because they were snooty and they were pretty comical. And of course, the way that they actually drank sherry and kept it like in decanters, you know, in their living room, as opposed to like in the refrigerator, like it's not the way that sherry could be consumed, but it kind of has this weird trajectory. And it has definitely kind of enjoyed a renaissance. And one of the reasons for that is because there have been some really dedicated professionals who embraced it, loved it, and have kind of prophesized about it. And she talks about those people. And One thing I liked is that a lot of these folks are people that I've met or they worked at bars that I've been to. And she talks about, you know, Paul Greco from Terroir in New York or other, you know, bartenders. My friend Derek Brown, who is, she describes him as the sherry guy from DC. And I've known Derek for a long time. And he actually opened a bar in DC that was just dedicated to sherry. Or my friend Chantal Tseng, who, you know, is probably now the sherry person of DC. So it's a little bit nostalgic to read through all of this, but bartenders and sommeliers and a few small importers are definitely responsible for kind of bringing sherry back to its heyday and featuring it, you know, on menus in restaurants. And it needs some love. And this book does a really good job of detailing that. So it was helpful for me in my research for my diploma case study exam, but also it weaves a really cool story. And I guess it diverges from champagne in that there's so much that they share, but I think people have always kind of liked champagne. It hasn't really needed as many ambassadors to preach the goodness of it as sherry certainly has. I guess that's kind of a long-winded way of saying that she spreads the love and the credit around to all of the people who've helped really kind of bring it about. Now, there are definitely chapters in this book that are just a little bit more straightforward and factual, and they're less nostalgic for me. I mean, she talks through the major three sherry towns and bodegas of note within them. And I really appreciate the way that it's done. She describes the history, the people behind it, and her favorite wines from that bodega. And bodega just meaning winery, not like little corner store, but just, you know, a winery or a cellar. I've only been to sherry the one time. I've actually only been to one producer. But a lot of these producers, if you're in the wine world, are probably going to be familiar names to you because some of them are big and famous, like Gonzalez Bias or Valdespino. But they still make some really, really fantastic wines. And so she details the style of wine, the style of wines that the bodega generally produces, the general price point that the wines can be found at, and then her top five wines. I should mention that another big difference between sherry and champagne is that even the best of the best, the oldest and the rarest of sherry is not that expensive. And that just is attributable to the fact that, you know, not that it's not rare. A lot of these wines are certainly very, very rare and certainly very, very old. But it goes more to the idea that if something is in great demand, scarcity is going to dictate higher prices. And while sherry is certainly more in demand now than it was 15 years ago, there's more wines available now, it's still a really good value. And I love a value. I love being a thrifty sommelier. And so some of the greatest wines in the world that you can get from sherry might be like $15. And if you can find another place in the world where that's some of the best wines are that inexpensive, like I would be super impressed. Now, she details how sherry should best be stored and consumed, and you should maybe temper your expectations depending on the location. Because if somebody doesn't understand sherry, if they're not serving it, you know, regularly, if they're leaving a bottle open for months on end, it's not going to show its best condition. And some sherries certainly should be refrigerated. And one of the best is Manzanilla. So Manzanilla is a Fino style sherry. It comes from specifically the town of Sanlúcar de Barrameda, which is the town that I visited. And it's salty and briny and tastes like almonds and apples, and it goes with anything from the sea. And ideally, you buy it in a half bottle, so 375 milliliters, because it is the freshest of the styles. And so it's not meant to be aged once open. You want to consume a bottle in, well, a couple of days. But she says something that's really funny in the profile of Sanlúcar de Barrameda and the bodegas that are in that town. And she says that here in this little stretch, this little town, there's a strip of seafood restaurants and bars packed with locals feasting on the bounty they've supplied. These are being fishermen. And sitting at any one of these little bars, it's not hard to wish that life was one long Spanish Saturday, punctuated by plates of langostinos and an endless parade of Manzanilla, from the half bottle, of course. In a testament to the lifestyle in Sanlúcar, Manzanilla is rarely ordered by the glass here. If you don't have time for at least a half bottle, you don't have time for lunch. If that could be a thing, I love it. I love that idea so much. And then you typically, since it is a fortified wine, you typically drink a smaller amount of sherry, I guess if you're not traveling to Spain with me. And so you might drink like a 2.5 to 3 ounce glass as opposed to like a 4 to 6 ounce glass because it is stronger. But that's only a couple of small glasses out of a half bottle. But I just really like that idea that if you don't have time to finish a half bottle, you don't have time for lunch. And it sounds really great. And I have to include another little story about Sanlúcar. So she details the origin of the name Manzanilla because it's a specific name for the style of sherry that's aged in Sanlúcar. And this made me smile when I read about this. So there's a theory that perhaps it comes from the Spanish word manzana, which is means apple, because there's kind of like a Granny Smith green apple, you know, taste. That's one theory. Another theory is, well, I experienced this firsthand. So when Devin and I went to Sanlúcar, we were so proud of ourselves. We'd taken the train. I think I mentioned we fell asleep and we ended up in Cadiz. We had to take a bus back and we got to Sanlúcar and the sun is setting and we find ourselves the first bar that we can find and we look out at the Atlantic and we decide we want to order ourselves some manzanilla. So we do. Imagine our surprise when the server at the bar brings us a pot and 2 cups of chamomile tea. Well, manzanilla is also the word for chamomile. And so there's a thought that maybe that like chamomile tea, like floral herbal note is reminiscent in the manzanilla sherry. And perhaps that's where its name came from. But we were like, what? It's warm and beautiful and sunny. I don't want to drink hot herbal tea right now. So shame on us. We didn't know that, but now we do. And she details that, which I thought was really funny. It is the perfect wine for lunching and for, you know, a hot day, because while it's alcoholic, it's fortified, it's at least 15 degrees alcohol by volume, because of the way it's made and aged, it has a remarkable lightness. And so it's a very fresh wine and it's a very, very food friendly wine. And she, you know, proceeds to detail different bodegas, including the one that we visited, Bodegas Hidalgo La Gitana. And I brought back some sherries from our visit, and it's a special, special place. It made me feel really, really grateful that I made the plan to go visit that while I was in Spain. And so the visiting of the towns and talking about the bodegas is, I think, really important. Now, there's a whole section, and it's pretty lengthy, in this book about cocktails, because sherry was originally used in cocktails in sort of like pre-prohibition United States. And it's definitely bartenders and those who have embraced sherry behind the bar have been a huge part of its resurgence. And she includes a really important section in here about how to stock your sherry bar should you choose to incorporate sherry into cocktails, because yes, it's a wine, but it makes for a very delicious ingredient in cocktails. And she recommends what types and what examples of specific bottlings. And not surprisingly, these are some of the more, again, sherry is never going to be that expensive compared to its other wines of equal prestige and age. But specific bottlings that are appropriate for use in cocktails, but also not the rarest of the rare air. It would be like, how do I say, like making a mimosa with a vintage prestige cuvée champagne. Maybe that's not the champagne that you want to use. Maybe you want to use something that's non-vintage dated that you can get, you know, with regularity on more options. And that same theory also applies. But when I say that there's a big section on cocktails, I mean it. It's like 50 pages of a 255 page book. And not all cocktails have pictures, but some of them do. I should mention that the pictures in this book are gorgeous. And the cocktails are a combination of classic and historic, and then some new and modern creations. Probably the first and most important cocktail is the Sherry Cobbler, and she talks about the history. There's a beautiful picture. There's recipes and instructions for making it. And then she also includes some cocktails of her own making, and I love a good pun. And one of those would be the Mariah Sherry. And she talks about where she came up with that name. There's a beautiful picture. And then, you know, there's instructions on how to make it. And so the cocktail section is really fun. I would also have to be remiss without calling out again my friend Derek Brown, who she mentions was Washington, D.C.'s poster boy for sherry. And he created something called the Kojo cocktail as an homage or an honor to Kojo Namdi, who had the show. He's now retired on NPR, the WAMU in DC. I used to listen to this all the time. It was like a career goal of mine to get on the Kojo Namdi show. But for his 15th anniversary of his show, Derek Brown made a special cocktail called the Kojo cocktail for him. And I love that it made it into this book. It's like all these flashbacks from, you know, early on in my career when I was, you know, getting into wine, working as a sommelier, and then, you know, obviously the 10 years that I spent in DC. I'm not a cook, but there are recipes and pictures for some simple Spanish food that goes really well with sherry. And there is a 2-page spread all about Spanish ham, because it is important to understand it. It's a huge part of Spanish culture, and the places of origin for the best Spanish hams are really, they're in southern Spain, close to where sherry is produced. So if it grows together, it goes together. There's even a section on sherry vinegar. There is literally no stone left unturned in this book. So, what works? Man, so much. This is a combination of great storytelling. There's a little bit of fun humor. She likens sherry to marijuana at one point, how it like it's like the gateway drug. A certain type of sherry is a gateway drug, or she talks about the evaporation in the barrels, which we call the angel share in spirits production. as the OG pouring out a little wine for your homies. Like, she has this really approachable style of talking and storytelling. It's like 95% factual. And then there's like a little bit of personality that's like sprinkled in there just to add a little bit of like entertainment. The photos are gorgeous. It's really, really informative. And if you were buying sherry for yourself or buying sherry for a restaurant program or hotel program that you're working in, maybe not all of the producers that you could find are contained in here, but all the important ones are. Some of them are new, many of them are old, but this would be a great reference to look up specific history of different bodegas and the style of wine they produce, and then also specific bottlings of wine. And then, of course, the cocktails are really fun, and there's good instructions on, you know, how to employ sherry in cocktails, what examples of sherry that you should use. So there's a lot of really, really good and entertaining information. And as I said, the pictures are gorgeous. It's aesthetically a very delicious, well, aesthetically, it's beautiful, but look, I said delicious. I can't even stop myself. It's just, this book is delicious. As for what doesn't work, not much. I think this is a really, really important book. Again, this is close at mind because I was recently obviously testing on, you know, this case study. And in terms of the books about sherry that are out there, Peter Leem's book, which is out of print and extremely difficult to get, this one. And then there's a lot of like old books on sherry. And I read some of them. They are dry and they are boring and they are not interesting and there's no good pictures. And I think this is a really important contribution to this amazing and historic style of wine. And to understand it, this book is really key to that. And it's also accessible. And so, yeah, you can use the internet, but if you love books the way I love books, this is a book that I think that would be really key to helping understand it. It's going to make you want to drink sherry, which, you know, then it achieves its goal. That's its destiny. So if you couldn't figure out, this book is a 100% buy. This is a wine book review podcast. Sometimes I stray from that, but sherry is one of the world's great wines. It is definitely the wine world's best kept secret. You can drink the best of the best for a fraction of what the other best of the best wines from other places in the world are. There's a style for every palate, a glass for every palate, as my friend Shakira likes to talk about. And it's, you know, and you could, you know, cook up a little tapas feast for your friends. So all I want to do now is finish recording and pour myself a cold glass of Fino Sherry and maybe eat some Marcona almonds and find some fried fishes somewhere. But thankfully, this cuisine and these wines are relatively available all over the country and the world. And I would think that this book would make you want to drink and eat those things with great gusto. So I love this book. I think it's really great. I guess if there's one small negative, it's the point that books, they are static and the wine world is not. And so, yes, as of this year, in the last couple of months, there have been some new and dramatic changes to the rules and regulations for the Sherry Denominación de Origen. You can look those up for yourselves. It doesn't negate this book. So yes, it's not the most up-to-date information, but I don't think there's a book on sherry that encapsulates that new information because it's so stinking brand new. So small little caveat, but it's a great book. I think you should buy it. It belongs on your shelf. Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe and hopefully you like what you hear and feel free to leave us a rating. Until next time, see you then. This episode was brought to you by Study Hall, my show on Somm TV, where you can learn the ins and outs of being a sommelier and get helpful hints and tips for studying for all your exams. Get a year of Somm TV for only $25 with the code STUDYHALL.